Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and like all the podcasts here at WFYI, they are on Spotify. Joining me on the line is the department chair and head AC, that's air conditioning, of the Communication, Media, and Journalism Department of the University of North Georgia, Jeff Marker, but that's not how I know him. We've been friends since college. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm good. And yes, at a small university, you have to do a lot of different things. And so, yes, I run the department. I fix the air conditioning. The whole thing.
How many meetings do you have a week?
I don't even know. My calendar looks ridiculous.
Understood.
But, you know, it's better than my first job, which was shoveling manure. So things are looking up. I have to keep perspective, you know, on busy weeks.
Yes, or as Ted Knight once said, well, the world needs ditch diggers too.
Yeah, he sent many young men to the gas chamber, didn't want to do it. Thought it was good for them.
Ladies and gentlemen, these are your pledge dollars at work. So I know it's a big time this week, but as I was talking to Jeff earlier this week to prepare for this, the Oscars happen every year. Kirk Douglas only dies once. So we're going to start with that, and then we'll get into what everybody wants to hear, Oscar analysis from 250-something white guys. Hard-hitting stuff.
Yep.
But I guess to start with, do you remember your first cinematic encounter, or I guess any pop culture encounter with Kirk Douglas? Because we are both of the same age.
Sure. Spartacus was my introduction to him. And then later on, they see Paths of the Glory. That was another early exposure to him, and he's so good in that movie.
How old?
Yeah, and so then, I'm sorry?
How old were you?
Spartacus came pretty young. I don't remember even being a teenager when I saw Spartacus. And then got into my teens and could actually appreciate something like Paths of Glory and some of his other earlier work. Like, he made some really great film noir early in his career.
It's funny you mentioned. First off, I can say, Jeff, do you like movies about gladiators?
Yes, I do.
In this case, yes. As I was thinking back about this, of course, Kirk Douglas died earlier this week at the age of 103. He got his money's worth.
Isn't it nice to talk about a celebrity who has passed? And we don't need to be sad. Anybody who lives to 103, you know, God bless you.
Yes. And now Olivia de Havilland, I think, is at the top of the order, top of the mountain there.
Right.
But anyway, I was thinking back about my first encounters with Kirk Douglas, and I think it was thanks to guys like Rich Little and Frank Gorshin, because, you know, they were on TV. You know, Impressionists were huge in the 70s, folks. And so I remember seeing that. I remember he hosted Saturday Night Live, and one of his sketches was an album of Kirk Douglas imitating people imitating Kirk Douglas.
Good grief. That's a hook.
It was. Well, it was SNL in the 70s. You had to work with what you had. And also, that the first thing I saw of his was in the theater. Do you remember The Man from Snowy River?
I do, yeah.
This kind of odd Australian, and really good Australian Western, and it was not a Kirk Douglas vehicle. He just kind of happened to be in it. But it was a name I'd always heard. And if you remember, the late 70s, early 80s for Kirk, not the best work.
Yeah, I recently revisited Saturn III, and I'm very fortunate.
I mean, God bless Kirk Douglas to have a, you know, cinematic wife in Farrah Fawcett, but But that's a whole recurring thing with Douglas. We'll get to that, in a little bit. But yeah, Saturn III and the Final Countdown and the Villain, which is another offshoot that Jeff Marker and I have talked about. Hal Needham Films not starring Burt Reynolds.
It's a very specific niche. Yeah.
Well, if you think the films of Burt Reynolds and Hal Needham are spotty, look at The Villain and Rad and Body Slam and something that Jeff is going to make me revisit sometime soon, Megaforce.
Megaforce, what an opus. Yes. And I'm just talking about the hair. The hair is epic in that.
Great Barry Bostwick 70s hair.
Yes, but to return to Mr. Douglas.
Yes.
Yeah, so let's forget about the end of the career when he showed up on an episode of Touched by an Angel. Strikes me, looking back at his early days, is how quickly he becomes a leading man. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to take, a whole decade of sort of working his way up. This had such a presence that it takes him about 2 years and a handful of roles until his name is above the title. And then he does a couple of, you think of him as, this strapping man, and at least I do, the Gladiator movie, and
sure.
He's in all these action movies in his prime. But he has the Glass Menagerie early on.
Yep.
And Morning Becomes Electra. I don't associate Kirk Douglas with Eugene O'Neill, So the guy could do a lot of things. And he was smart enough to recognize that being a producer in the era of the late 40s and throughout the 50s was a very good idea for an actor. Betty Davis was one of the first people to, in her famous agent Lou Wasserman, sort of figure that out before everybody else. But Douglas ends up producing many of his own movies, so he got to actually have some creative control and input, which was kind of new. And so he jumped onto that very early on, which was wise.
Exactly. I revisited Champion earlier this week. Everybody, there's certain film nerds like us that when a particular person in the industry dies, you grab something to revisit, and that was the one for me. But also. The stuff that he did that made him, unique early on was, and you mentioned Glass Menagerie, he had a combination of swagger and tenderness. And there were a lot of films that he wasn't able to later show that off. But there's some lovely moments in Champion, and the fact that he's the gentleman caller in Glass Menagerie, so he's got that. Early 19th, 20th century lingo, but he has some lovely scenes with Laura. And Champion is, and I was talking with a couple of guys that are not fans of boxing films, but this film was a great example of it's not about whether he wins the fight or not. It's this cautionary tale that just so happens that it's set in the boxing industry.
Right, and Champion, based on a Ring Lardner story, which gets us into another aspect of Douglas's career, Spartacus marked Dalton Trumbo's return.
Yep.
And it wouldn't have happened. So Dalton Trumbo hired as the screenwriter for Spartacus, and by all accounts, that wouldn't have happened if Douglas wouldn't have made it happen.
Yeah, exactly. So between the Dalton Trumbo stuff and forming his own production company, way ahead of his time. I had a moment. We all have these as film folks. There are certain titles that fall through the cracks. And then friends are stunned that you haven't seen such and such. I know we've done this with each other, but the one that happened for me, because I just bought it on Criterion earlier this year, had never seen it, and now it's one of my favorite Kirk Douglas films, is Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole.
Oh, gosh, I haven't seen that in so long. For listeners, Matt does this to me constantly. I teach film history. It's my living. And yet he digs up these titles where even I feel like, gosh, I better get to work filling in all these gaps.
This was Wilder's follow-up to Sunset Boulevard, and is even darker than Sunset Boulevard, where he's a hotshot reporter who is stuck in a small town trying to build himself back up. And a guy is stuck in a cave on a mineshaft accident, and he keeps him there to keep expanding the story. Obligatory 21st century joke about journalism here.
Yeah, but that's where we were. I mean, you can't overstate how many movies like that America was making in the late 40s and early 50s, that whole sort of film noir trend. It's full of everyday people just doing awful things to each other. You look back at that period, and we think of that as a sort of gosh, that whole post-war baby boom, and it's sort of an economic upswing and everything like that. But something, as far as the movies were concerned, something was very wrong with us in the late 40s, early 50s.
Well, it was the opposite. I think it was the opposite. Obviously, the post-World War II suburban boom where, you know, everybody got, two kids and a house in the suburbs and a car, and everything was fine. We were turning into the man in the gray flannel suit. And fortunately, there was a counterculture, and there was enough of an art world that says this isn't not everything is what it seems. Wait, is this
behind every white picket fence is a scheme?
So wait, is this 1948 or 2020?
Yes, yeah, nice segue.
You're welcome. But so the other thing I mentioned, I was going back earlier to my first encounters with Douglas's work. Was after The Man from Snowy River, and this was a great thing of, and this is for you young folks out there who just stream movies, when video stores started to pop up, because we had like a handful of movie channels. I think this was back when HBO wasn't even on 24 hours a day, but the what I would call the center of the video store, old titles started to pop up, and I would get curious as a teenager of, oh, I know that name, and you put it in. And that's where I discovered Out of the Past and Champion and every film he did with Burt Lancaster. And eventually, yeah, Spartacus and Paths of Glory. And, thank goodness for video stores at that time.
Yeah, you can't get too nostalgic and rewrite the history of video stores because, you know, it's not like they were perfect. However, there was no algorithm keeping me from finding things. Online, it's great to go down the rabbit hole on IMDb and Amazon, but you get on the Amazon and a lot of video services, and they're only showing you things they think you want to know. In video stores, you could just wander to the far wall and discover things, things completely out of your experience. And that part of video stores was really wonderful.
If you get a chance, and I wish HBO would stream more of their old documentaries. I'm still waiting for the document. I would actually purchase the documentary HBO did about the 68 Tigers. But anyway, there was a documentary they did about Kirk and Michael Douglas. And this was a guy, I think Kirk Douglas is dead. He's obviously dead. He's still griping that he didn't get to do the film version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Good for his son, but I bet those were fun Thanksgivings every year, bringing up Cuckoo's Nest.
Well, you know, the roles that get away hurt.
They do. But, you know, don't tell – I think just TCM was doing a retrospect and, you know, those kind of six-minute retrospects. And ironically enough, Brett Ratner was doing the one on Douglas. And he talked about the last time he met Douglas at some outing. Douglas went up to him, you know, he's 100, and says, put me in one of your movies so I could kick Jackie Chan's ass. Which is a Douglas thing.
It's quintessential, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, there was, I think, you know, one of the times he was not wheeled out. He actually walked on his own at the Academy Awards and is totally hitting on Anne Hathaway in front of everybody. But the story in the documentary about him and Michael was that apparently anytime Kirk called Michael's house and Michael picked up the phone, he would always say, I don't want to talk to you.
So you have visions of Catherine Zeta-Jones, you know, refereeing those Thanksgiving dinners. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, most definitely. And I guess if you really want to go down a rabbit hole, there's something it's almost a Hannibal Buress thing starting to bubble up, but I'm going to let you folks do that on your own volition. So, however, from a cinematic world, go find some Kirk Douglas and enjoy yourself because, the man's resume is very impressive.
Indeed.
All right, here it is, folks. The Academy Award analysis by two 50-something, 40-something straight white men. How you want this for you? Where should we start? Makeup?
Sure. Let's do that.
Because, the only other big film opening this week is Harley Quinn, and we're not allowed to talk about Margot Robbie, so we're not going to do that.
Well, we have to talk about Margot Robbie in the Oscars 19 discussion.
Yes, that's true. That's true. All right, so... Well, no, I want to start with at this point in 2020, Jeff, where are you with the Academy Awards?
I'm where I've been for a long time. I mean, they're a nice advertisement for the film industry.
Yep.
I have a philosophical problem with award shows anyway. You know, they single out or just sort of divide out these, you know, handful of films over and over again. And what gets lost, especially in a year like 2019, is there were a few dozen films that I will enthusiastically recommend to people. And so you start to lose sight of the fact that it's not just the major stars, it's not just the known directors and established talent that are doing really exciting things. In fact, the most exciting things usually aren't being highlighted by the Oscars. However, I'm going to get sucked in. You know, I can have all these principles and I can be crabby and, you know, sound my age right now, but it's Friday and I'm starting to, you know, wonder, well, who is going to win?
Do you have your menu planned?
No, we don't really do that. Maybe we should. I don't know. I have my snarky comments all ready to go, though.
I bet you do. I bet your wife, Linda Macbeth, loves that.
Yes, she does. I am hilarious. Just ask her.
I actually have. This and the Tonys are the only award shows I actually focus on. And yeah, there is a business aspect to it. I think it was Roger Ebert who said, if you're nominated, you're guaranteed one film. If you win, you're guaranteed three. So there is a certain business aspect of it. But I also have this looming thing over me. If something other than Best Actor, if Joker wins something other than Best Actor, I'm probably not going to be a happy person.
No. I mean, okay, let's start there. Joker, it's a terrific performance. I mean, I don't even care how you feel about the rest of the film.
Absolutely.
To be able to perform that uncontrollable laughing and just all these situations he gets into, his performance is amazing. I'm not impressed by anything else in that film.
No, and I use that as the example of if you like something, it's an homage. If you don't like something, it's a ripoff. And I knew going in that there was going to be elements of Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy. I didn't know they were going to lift that much.
Right.
And my fear is that this is the year that they're gonna honor quote unquote the comic book film or the super, you know, the hero films, when they should have done it with maybe with Black Panther. But so that's my fear, that that's going to be a grandiose choice on their part. And of course, we'll have more SNL sketches about white male rage.
Yeah, speaking of, if you have not seen
the
SNL Oscar the Grouch parody of Joker, oh, my word, it's brilliant.
Yes, it is. So, okay, so we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 8, we have 9, yeah. For Best Picture, there's been buzz going on that the safe pick might be 1917.
Yeah, I know. That's another one. So if you want to go ahead and kill a couple of categories with one stone here, I'm all for Roger Deakins winning cinematography.
Yes. Well, Roger Deakins is a treasure, and he should.
Yeah, but also, I mean, really, you've got a war film in which certain shots, entire scenes look like a painting in motion. I mean, it is really a beautiful film. And the whole one take conceit was so difficult to plan and execute technically, you know, just for Deakins and his team, because they had to, I mean, of course it's not one continuous take for any part of that, but they had to match the end of one shot to the beginning of the next shot.
Correct.
So that in post-production with the compositing and all of that, in addition to using light in a masterful way, he also had to do that for every single portion of the shoot. And so that part of that film is really incredible. And I think for the first 45 minutes, the one take conceit works. And then to me, it just falls apart. I'm not impressed by the waterfall, you know, et cetera. And so I don't think that's a very strong script, and I don't think it adds much in terms of theme or story to the genre. And so I don't think it's the best film, however, of those 9. And given how previous award shows tend to predict these things, it does look like we're headed toward 1917 winning.
I had a colleague who referred to it as Grand Theft Auto World War One.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah. I was wondering for a while if the safe choice because it's one of his milder films, would have been Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, possibly. And, you know, it's another filmmaker who's undoubtedly, you know, at least one of the more interesting and exciting filmmakers of his generation, who tends not to get a whole lot of love from the Oscars. You know, my relationship with Once Upon a Time, I was dreading it, quite frankly, because I really loathed Tarantino's last three movies. You know, this is a director that Once Upon a Time influenced my career choice.
But,
you know,
I'm sorry, I wanted to preface the revisionist revenge trilogy, I think is what it's sort of kind of known as.
Right, yeah. And so when I heard that Tarantino was going to do a story about the Manson family, I'm just not interested. Well, it's not that. That's not what that movie is. And so I enjoyed it much more the second time because I didn't have these sort of, you know, preconceived notions going in. It's a fun film in a really perverted way, which is what we want from Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. I think the production design on it is amazing. I don't know if everybody realizes this.
God, yes.
That's actually not CGI making those storefronts from the late 60s in L.A. Those were real physical storefronts, and they sort of redressed L.A. to look like it did however many years ago. And they had to be very careful with their sight lines, with moving the camera and that sort of thing. And so on that level, they really do recreate the era really perfectly. So I think it deserves to win for production design. And I do think it's kind of a return for him. It's bold to rewrite history in that way. And in this case, it's more clear to me why he's doing that. You know,
right. The
fairy tale that he presents is much more tragic, or makes the real events that much more tragic. And I see him, this is an era that he loves. He has called it his Roma, which I think is fun.
Wait a minute, are we talking about the film from last year or Fellini's?
No, we're talking about the film from last year. So that's fun. I think what you see at the end of that movie is him exercising his anger at how that era came to an end, which is interesting, you know?
Yeah. I think this is I had to defend this film a couple of times because people were kind of up in arms about the violence aspect of it. This is his least violent film since Jackie Brown.
You've got this sort of explosion at the end, but that's it.
That's really it, and I think this might be the gateway for him. I mean, it is. You're in for a haul. It's about 240, and I didn't mind taking that trip. My wife was ready to leave after DiCaprio got back from Italy, but I think it's his easiest watching film since Jackie Brown. As far as the story, and yeah, he loves that era, and that era fascinates me as far as the pecking order and show business. So I think a lot of young people should check that out. And yeah, the treatment of the Margot Robbie character, Sharon Tate, the fact that she is basically cinematic pure innocence, and the fact that you see actually Tate in the film as opposed to CGI DiCaprio in The Great Escape. I think it's of the revenge trilogy that he's created, this is the easiest one to swallow by far.
And they also, it doesn't play like a history lesson, but the fact is they use Rick Dalton in his career to give a really great overview of what was happening in the industry, and especially the actors who had been around for a little while. I mean, he nails that whole sort of sojourn in Italy. That's exactly what happened with a lot of actors, and that in the real titles and then the fake titles he uses, all of that was so much fun and so on point too. So it's a very well-researched film. And then of course, you know, he completely goes against what really happened.
Right. Exactly. I think that and Midsommar are the two films that captured dread and maintained it for, well, I mean, it's kind of, I know that's a, by the way, don't do that as a double feature, but the sense of dread throughout and then the payoffs at the end.
Right. Yeah, I get that.
And so I think also there are theories and there are counter theories. We mentioned Once Upon a Time. I'm going to mention Brad Pitt, the fact that he's the only actor in the supporting character who doesn't have an Academy Award except for producing 12 Years a Slave. You think he'll get it?
I think it's a strong possibility. And among the five that they chose, among the nominees, I'm fine with that. I don't buy into this whole thing of, well, he's just being Brad Pitt. He's just being a movie star. That's bunk, you know? And so I think Pesci was really great in Irishman because he sort of played against his usual persona. He's not the one who's demonstrative and sort of volatile all the time. He's the calming presence in that film. So it's a lot of restraint, especially for him. Everybody's going to hate me for saying this. I wasn't all that impressed by Tom Hanks in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Oh, you hate you're a hater of cinema. We know that.
That is just not true. Rogers is a personal hero. I thought Hanks was just kind of mannered. I never forgot he was acting.
Okay. Or that it's Tuesdays with Maury.
Right, exactly. But Pitt is completely natural in that role and just gobbles up everything every time he's on screen. And so, yeah, I'm fine with him winning in that category.
Okay. Are there any categories in here that you have a particular that you're going to be paying particular attention to? For me, I want Thelma Schoonmaker to win Best Editing so I can hear everybody on the internet gripe about how she edited a 3.5-hour film. It's like when Ken Branagh got nominated for adapting Hamlet. It's not just the text, gang. It's what you do with the text.
Sure, and that's a sort of provocateur stance you're taking there.
I'll translate for everybody. Being a D-bag.
Here, I have really ambivalent feelings about that because I have great respect for her, but I don't know where to put the blame on what went wrong with The Irishman, because to me what went wrong is the last 30 minutes, and it's the use of Anna Paquin's character, and I'm not even talking about it from a sort of social standpoint. The movie is not about his relationship with his daughter.
No.
So why do we spend the last 20 to 30 minutes on that? And so it's a problem with the script. So to get ahead, I don't think it deserves to win for screenplay for that reason. But, you know, is it – whose fault is it? Is it purely the screenwriter's? Is it Scorsese's fault? Or is it Schoonmaker's for saying, hey, Marty, this is not working, you know, for not saying that? And so for the parts of the movie that work, I think she did a fine job and she had a great career. But I think you got to give that award to Yang Jin-mo for Parasite. It's a perfectly paced film.
And I think Parasite's also going to get the foreign film. Well, I'm sorry, international feature film. We could talk forever about what we see on the internet, but reading columns from film critics that are afraid of a subtitled film winning Best Picture really makes me sad.
It does, and we just pause for a moment to talk about how ridiculous that category is. International feature film. Are you kidding me? Look at the ownership of the companies. Look at the talent in front and behind the camera for these things that we dub American movies. I mean, how many people who worked on 1917 are from the United States? And where'd the funding for that movie come from? Where'd they shoot it? Same goes for Jojo Rabbit. I mean, this is absurd. Most of the Little Women cast were not born in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so it is just absurd that the industry continues to sort of segment out this best picture category and sort of assume that means best American picture. And yet we have this international category. It doesn't reflect the reality of the situation, and it's just frankly dumb. And it perpetuates this aversion that people have to stereotyped, and not stereotyped, subtitled films.
But wait a minute, Jeff. Your Cincinnati Reds and my Detroit Tigers at one time won the World Series.
Right, exactly.
We're getting really snarky here, folks. So
we are, but this is, you know, you ask, you know, where I am with the Oscars. This is an ongoing problem that is not getting any better. Most releases, you know, get on Box Office Mojo or some other source for box office receipts. All of our movies make the majority of their money outside of the U.S., you know, so it's just more evidence. Like, why are we doing this? It's a global industry at this point. We didn't create that. The industry created that. They're all international companies and internationally made films. So stop doing this sort of segregation between things that we dub American and things not.
What he said. And I didn't get a harump out of that guy.
Yeah. There you go. So before we leave Best Picture entirely, can I air another grievance?
Please.
You know, you can't get too upset about the Oscars. However, it upsets me that The Farewell was ignored entirely other than in the Best Supporting Actress category. And by the way, actress in the supporting role... Wait, I'm wrong.
No, it got blanked out completely. No, there's a whole big Oscar be white kind of thing.
It is. To me, that's one of the most egregious omissions. You know, The Farewell, I'm sorry, is one of the best films of the year. No doubt a top 10 film, much stronger than something like Jojo Rabbit or The Irishman. And then... in that amazing supporting role, they don't even get recognition. The screenplay doesn't get recognition. This is related to our subtitle complaint.
Well, and I think
because this is an American movie, but it was shot in China. So guess what? They speak Mandarin. Anyway, that's the one. That is the one that like my blood starts to run a little bit faster because that one was shut out so completely, and it's such a fine piece of work.
For me, there was The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which made my top five. And I'm sure there are reasons why it didn't get in, and I haven't done the checkup on that. But my top film of last year, and I thought it should have been for Best Documentary, was Amazing Grace. But I like old school 60s, 70s concert films, and it's hard to go up against something like Fursama or American Factory or any of the other titles if you're just having 90 minutes of Aretha Franklin singing. But that's just me.
Right. No, I get it. I'm with you. I have problems in the documentary category too. They didn't recognize The Great Hack, which is one of the most relevant stories of our time, not for nothing. You had Homecoming, the Beyonce concert film. It's the best concert film in decades. It stands right alongside Last Waltz, in my opinion, and the greatest in that genre. And it hasn't been recognized by anybody. And if it goes anywhere, it goes into the documentary category.
Yes. So.
All right. So now we are sounding like 40 and 50 year old white men just ranting. So let's get more organized.
No. I guess. Well, I was going to ask you, since we've seen most of these, what have you been doing to cleanse your palate?
I watched the entire season of The Witcher, and it didn't work out all that well as a palate cleanser.
Why? Gee, I wonder why.
Well, it's being the father of a teenage child who, is into fantasy and sci-fi and whatnot. I figured I'd take – and everybody – my students keep talking about it. So I started watching it, and, I had that experience where the first few episodes, is this good or do I hate this? I'm not sure. And then you just have to complete the set. So I finished the season, and it didn't really get much better. And so I tell you what. This isn't really a palate cleanser, but what I am moving on to is we have a great festival down here in Georgia called the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival, and I'm lucky enough to moderate some screenings for them, and so I've been getting ready for that.
Okay. All right. That's not bad.
Yeah.
Do you have certain series that you have to watch as a trio?
Certain series that I have to watch?
Or certain shows. I'll give an example. Like at our house, there are certain series that we have to watch, all three of us. The last one was Fleabag. And then, there's some other ones where it's okay if she's watching it, if my daughter's watching it with my wife. Like, they will watch The West Wing anytime. For a while, they were watching Gilmore Girls together. For it being just Emma and I, it's The Sopranos. So I'm wondering if there's one that you all three have to watch at one time.
Your child is a little bit older than mine.
Right.
So we can't jump into something like Fleabag just yet. The latest series like that was The Mandalorian. It was a Star Wars property that my child and I agreed on, which doesn't happen very often anymore. And my wife loved it too. And so that one was a huge hit with us. And so we just breezed right through that and have rewatched some episodes of it. And then they have, you brought the West Wing. I'm quite proud of my, my young son, who this is very much not the kind of thing he normally consumes, but my wife showed him the West Wing and he absolutely loved it. You know, he's an aspiring writer and he recognized right away how well that show was written. So yeah, they've been working on that. And I love that show, but there's just not very often that we all three get to sit down and watch it.
That Sorkin guy. Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, don't interview him, but just let him work. That's what you do with Aaron Sorkin.
No, absolutely. The other one that as a trio is Modern Love, which is really easy because it's really episodic. And I love John Carney's work. And we're actually getting to the portions of the show, of the episodes not written or directed by John Carney. And it's still pretty good.
Gotcha. Are we talking about the Oscars?
We did. So I think it sounds like you vented and I vented, and you know, we'll see who wins, and then we get to talk about this next week. Will your class like bum rush you on Monday morning?
We've already had this conversation, you know, and it's the whole you know, we're all going to get sucked in regardless whether we want to or not thing. And so absolutely, when they come back next week, it'll be unavoidable. We all will have grudgingly watched the ceremony, and we will have to talk about it.
Cool. All right. Well, Jeff, I know you got to get booking, but I really appreciate your time from one grumpy old man to another.
Yes. Let's rant even more often, if possible. It's been great fun.
And by the way, I have to bring up, we do this once a year. We have a cinematic bet involving the Michigan-Ohio State game, and I have not made Jeff watch a movie in years. And as we were mentioning earlier, my punishment is a Hal Needham film not featuring Burt Reynolds, and it's Megaforce. I can't wait to see Megaforce. God help me.
Yeah. Medicaid, whatever you got to do to get ready for that one. And see, you continue to be a great sports fan, because I was not going to go there.
But, wait.
You went there.
Oh, we mean on the show?
I mean, period. You know, for listeners, you know, even when Matt's team loses, he calls me. I don't call him to, you know, rub it in or anything like that. He just steps right in and accepts the losing end of the bat. And so that's why it's fun that we do this.
Yeah. And while I'm doing it, I'm wearing my ridiculous khaki pants.
And eating beef.
And milk. Whole milk. None of that wimpy 2% stuff.
That's right. Stay right away from that.
All right, Jeff, thank you, and keep fighting toxic masculinity.
Wherever I go.
I don't have him on enough. That's Jeff Marker, the department chair and head AC of the Communication, Media, and Journalism Department at the University of North Georgia, and a friend for many, many decades, so always good to have him on the show. As a reminder, of course, the Academy Awards are happening Sunday night on ABC. There you go. Check it out if you want. That's Yeah, 8 p.m. Eastern. So there. I do want to talk about some other movie events that are going around in the area, and I'm going to tell you about some other films that have cleansed my palate, just catching up on the pile of movies that have been sent to me. Over at IU Cinema, Saturday at 4 o'clock, the 1937 film version of Lost Horizon. Sadly, it's not the 70s musical. And then at 7 o'clock, on Saturday, February the 8th at IU Cinema, as part of the Underground Film Series, the 1968 film Unstrap Me. Sunday, February 9th at 1 o'clock, they're showing House of Hummingbird, and then at 4 o'clock, Stateless Things, both part of the Korean Storytellers series. Monday, February 10th, you have Bora Kim, Kyungmoo Kim, and Darcy Paquette at 4 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, Bora Kim will be scheduled to be present for the 2018 film House of Hummingbird. Wednesday, February 12th, Seahorse at 7 o'clock. Freddie McConnell and director Jeannie Finley are scheduled to be present there. Friday, February 14th at 7 p.m. from 1973, A Warm December. And then Saturday, February 15th at 7 o'clock, a world premiere of the 1920 silent film version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with live orchestral accompaniment. If you've not had that experience, please do so. Monday, February 17th is a part of the classic black cinema of the 1970s from 7 o'clock on Monday, February 17th from 1975, Aaron Loves Angela. Really underrated film. Not a blaxploitation film. Just happens to be released in that era. Saturday, February 22nd at 4 o'clock as a part of the Cine Kids International Children's Film Series, the Cat Video Fest of 2020. That's right, a festival of cat films and footage. A percentage of the proceeds from this event will directly support Little Bub's Big Fund, the first national fund for special needs pets. That's Saturday, 4 o'clock, February 22nd, the Cat Video Fest 2020. And then at 7 o'clock that same day, they're showing Clueless. There you go. Sunday, February 23rd, Peer Kids at 1 o'clock, and All My Sons at 4 o'clock. So anyway, those are happening over at IU Cinema at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin. Mark your calendars, February 14th and 15th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., the original Billy Wilder film version of Sabrina with Humphrey Bogart, Audrey Hepburn, and William Holden. Thursday, February 13th at 1:30, there's a special free screening of Sabrina for those 55 and older. So you can check that out. Friday, February 21st at 7:30 p.m., they're showing Pretty Woman. And then Saturday, February 22nd at 2 p.m., I highly recommend. This was my top film of last year, but the Aretha Franklin concert documentary, Amazing Grace. And then that night, February 22nd, 7:30 p.m., they're showing Anchorman. So that is all happening over at the Artcraft Theater. New on video this week, well, Dr. Sleep, if you're into episodes or sequels to The Shining. The Nightingale, which is a film that didn't get enough love, so go look for that. Waves, which was a film that made my top 10, really good domestic drama. I'm curious that for some reason they're releasing on video Last Christmas with Emilia Clarke. You don't hold out and wait until, I don't know, December to put that out on video. I know it's common practice that you put it out, you know, months after the film's initial release. But who's watching Christmas films in February? Is it the Lifetime crowd? I don't know. Also coming out this week on video, Playing with Fire, the John Cena firefighter film that I actually sat through. Whew. I dedicate this one to Stacey Studeville, who should be a guest on the show next week. Her favorite filmmaker's newest opus, Lars von Trier's The House That Jack Built, is now out on video. And if you're a Golden Turkey Award fan, this is finally out on Blu-ray. Stephen Boyd, Tony Bennett, and the Oscar from 1966. Also good timing because the Academy Awards are coming up. So anyway, the film I watched, out of curiosity's sake, was a drama called The Good Liar. And this stars Helen Mirren, Ian McKellen, directed by Bill Condon. And it's the story of two people who meet on the internet, and Helen has found at least a new companion. We know as the film goes on that Ian McKellen's character is a career con artist, setting her up for, well, you know, con stuff. But this is one of those films that the performances are really good, and it helps even if it helps balance out a script that you know what's coming miles and miles ahead. So anyway, this is actually a pretty decent rental. So if you like Ian McKellen and Helen Mirren, good performances from them, even if it's a really predictable script. So there's your rental this week. Over at the Vogue on Monday the 10th, at 8 o'clock, they're showing Dirty Dancing. So if you want to see Dirty Dancing on the big screen at the Vogue, there's your chance. And then on Monday, February 24th at 8 p.m., they're showing The Shawshank Redemption. So you want to see it not on TNT, there's your opportunity. Over at the Buskirk Chumley Theater in Bloomington, on Sunday at 7:30 p.m., they're showing The Dark Crystal. On Valentine's Day, Friday, February 14th, at 7:30 p.m., they're showing Casablanca. Sunday the 15th at 7:30 p.m., they're showing Love and Basketball. Sunday the 16th at 6 p.m., the Indiana Forest Alliance will be hosting the Wild and Scenic Film Festival. That is happening there on Sunday, February 16th. Saturday, February 22nd at 7:30 p.m. They're showing The Wiz. Wednesday, February 26th at 4 o'clock, An Afternoon with Jesse Eisenberg. And then Friday and Saturday, Friday the 28th, Saturday the 29th, is the Pride Film Festival, courtesy of Bloomington Pride. So there's your events happening at the Buskirk Shumley Theater. Okay, some I'm catching up on films that have been sent to me, and you never know what you're going to get. The folks at Mill Creek Entertainment have put out a couple of – and these are these collections. Several video companies do this, where they will put two movies on the same disc, or they'll do a double feature. And then for me, it's figuring out why these two films are – it's kind of like my drive-in discussion. Like, why are these two films in the same thing? But this one's pretty easy. But Mill Creek Entertainment put out on one disc – from 1989, the family drama Dad. This is the one with Jack Lemmon, Ted Danson, Olympia Dukakis, Ethan Hawke, Kevin Spacey, Kathy Baker. And it's when the matriarch of the family, when Dukakis' character, who runs the household, has a heart attack. And Ted Danson, you know, uber yuppie because it's 1989, has to come in and spend time with his father and get him geared up for what happens if he should happen to live alone. And this is one of those films where an easy cinematic punching bag is the cinematic yuppie. Films like this, Hook, Regarding Henry, The Doctor, where you need to have some life event to turn a yuppie into a normal person. Decent performances from everybody. A little heavy-handed at times with the music, and one particular moment where you see Ted Danson carrying his father through the hallway of a hospital. But anyway, that is out on one disc, as well as the 1996 film version of the play I'm Not Rappaport. Good performances from Walter Matthau and Ozzie Davis, of two old men on a park bench. Because it's a film of a play, in this case, they open it up a little bit more than probably should. But good to see the two performances from Matthau and Davis. And these were obviously both put out by Universal, and of course, they both two films have grumpy old men in them. So that's probably the packaging attempt there. Watching these two films did inspire me because I have a stack of movies that I've purchased and haven't watched yet. These are first world problems at Film Sociology. But I had a Blu-ray of The Odd Couple, which I bought in December and just have not gotten around to watching. And I got to, and part of the reason why I bought it, it's besides it's on Blu-ray, but there's some special features on it. Plus, the big selling point, there's a commentary track by Chris Lemon and Charlie Matthau, the sons of the two stars. And hearing them spin tales about their fathers and this film is worth buying it alone. And this is another excuse why I'm pro physical copies, because I got to hear the stories by these two guys about their famous dads. And there, like I said, there's also some behind the scenes featurettes that go with it. So very happy to have that. The other one from Mill Creek Entertainment, and this is good timing because Joker's up for a slew of awards, but two films with Joaquin Phoenix, and both out by Universal. Do you remember the 2007 domestic drama Reservation Road? There are films that we get screeners for award consideration, and this one has award consideration screaming all over it. Joaquin Phoenix, Mark Ruffalo, Jennifer Connelly, Mira Sorvino, two Oscar winners, two nominees. It's the follow-up film for director Terry George, who had just done Hotel Rwanda. In fact, it says in the ad campaign, Hotel Rwanda. And what happens when Ruffalo's character accidentally hits the son of Joaquin Phoenix's character with his car? The kid dies. He doesn't stay. He drives off and doesn't get a clear description of the driver or the vehicle. Not crystal clear. And Phoenix's obsession with finding out who killed his son. Not a date film. It is, and if it is, watch something else afterward to cleanse your palate. Probably not the other film on this. Return to Paradise, the 1998 drama of three men who meet while they're in Malaysia, and two of them go back to the United States. The third one, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is busted by the police for drug possession and is set to hang for his crimes. and the two other bros have to come back, are being persuaded by lawyer Anne Heche to come back and face the music. So our hero in this, hero with, you know, finger quotes, is Vince Vaughn. So there's a lot of Vince Vaughn and Anne Heche scenes, and then seeing Joaquin Phoenix struggling in prison. It's a morality tale that there's a lot of changes going on, you know, that are coming a mile away, and he has to be, Vince Vaughn has to be the moral compass in this, and yeah, so that's out there. Take that for what it's worth. I mentioned I did on last week's show, but there's a couple of, and I did this on the house party, so sometimes I mix the blues house party with film sociology, but there's two cool documentaries about music. One is about Honey Boy Edwards. It's not a new title, but I just purchased it, and it's about Honey Boy Edwards as well as the history of the blues. And that's out on Earwig Music. You can go to earwigmusic.com and check that out. But MVD Visual put out a documentary called Betty Davis, They Say I'm Different. And this is about the funk pioneer singer, not the actress. But it's about her story. And her original voice, and what, because she was married to Miles Davis at one time, and then recorded in the 70s, and just kind of dropped out of the business because she was able to butt heads with music executives, old white music executives, and eventually just vanished. She wrote songs for the Commodores and the Chamber Brothers, knew Sly Stone, knew Jimi Hendrix before they were Sly Stone and Jimi Hendrix. And so the documentary talks about her impact in the music world and the fact that she comes out of isolation to have a part in this film to a certain degree. But it's and if you go to record stores, you've seen images of Betty Davis with her great afro and interesting outfits from the late 60s, early 70s. So if you're a fan of music, check out Betty Davis, They Say I'm Different. Shifting gears, thanks to Film Movement Classics, they gave me not one, but two films digitally restored from Ealing Studios, which was a British studio known for its films in the 40s and 50s. I talked to Simon Majumdar about these a little bit. But first off, from 1949, a film called Passport to Pimlico, and this is from director Henry Cornelius. And it's what happens when a small town discovers an ancient map and find out that in this document that their little British town is actually a part of Burgundy, France, and what happens when there's a border change. This is a film that stars Stanley Holloway, for you fans of My Fair Lady, and Margaret Rutherford. So there's a couple familiar faces if you're into old British cinema and My Fair Lady. And everything else Margaret did. But the other one from 1953, a color film from the same studio, called The Titfield Thunderbolt. And this is a small English town who finds out they're going to lose their train stop and what happens when the people in town try to run the rail system on their own, much to the besmirchment, new word, of the rival bus company that is happening in their small town. Stanley Holloway is also in this film. It's also directed by Charles Crichton, who, among other things, gave us films like The Lavender Hill Mob and, most notably, A Fish Called Wanda, at least most notably for me. I'm sure Simon would say otherwise. But both of them are just very charming, harmless, light fare, but fun little comedies. And I know that these were huge films in England back in the 40s and 50s. So if you want to get a small piece of film history in England, check out on Film Movement Classics, Passport to Pimlico and The Titfield Thunderbolt. Also out on Film Movement Classics, and good timing because it's the film from Bill Forsyth called Gregory's Girl. This was the film I believe he did before Local Hero. Local Hero, one of my all-time favorite films, and one that finally got a Criterion release. But this was a title I was familiar with but had never seen until now, so thank you to Film Movement Classics for this. But the story of young Gregory, an awkward Scottish teen who falls in love with a girl who turns out to be the first female player on the football team that he is on. And John Gordon Sinclair plays Gregory. Dee Hepburn is the objects of his affection. And similar to Local Hero, even though the film is about 90 minutes, it has a slower pace. It is not a slow film, but it has a pace where you get to follow the characters in his school, the teachers in his school, his family, his household, and it's not a John Hughes film where it's it's not a teen comedy from the 80s where it's all about does he or doesn't he get the girl. It's also working his way through his world where it's tall, you're tall and lanky and awkward, and even some of your friends call you weird and some of the teachers call you weird, but it's got a lovely heart, and to watch this and then watch Local Hero, I can see the bridge being built. So kudos to Film Movement Classics for putting out Bill Forsyth's Gregory's Girl. And then also, shifting gears, this is from Mill Creek Entertainment. This was sent to me, and I didn't realize until I got it that these were actually Hallmark Entertainment productions. It's a double feature of The Pathfinder and The Song of Hiawatha. So from 1996 and 1997. And The Pathfinder looks and feels a lot like Last of the Mohicans. Of course, it is listed as James Fenimore Cooper's The Pathfinder. Kevin Dillon is the white kid who is raised by Graham Greene. Of course, you have to have Graham Greene apparently in a film about Native Americans. Russell Means is in this, as well as a weird cameo by Stacey Keach as the Comte de Leon. So if you want to hear Stacey Keach with a French accent, this film is for you. But it's that story of what happens when a tracker played by Kevin Dillon and his father played by Graham Greene are torn between the French and the English settlers and whose allies are with whom. A year later, same filmmaker, same studio made The Song of Hiawatha, the story of Hiawatha, played in this case by Lightfoot, for you fans of Indian in the Cupboard. And the mysticism and his story of his rise to power. The film is also shoehorned in what happens when white characters, in this case a priest played by David Strathairn and a tracker played by Michael Rooker, show up and try to find out more about Hiawatha. And it's just interesting to see the ridiculous facial hair on David Strathairn. And if you took out Rooker and Strathairn's storyline, you'd have a shorter film, but it would be, I guess, more of a biopic about the Song of Hiawatha. Anyway, those were sent to me. They're out there. And the other thing that Mill Creek sent out, and it was fun to revisit it, and I still defend this film, and I don't care what Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd say in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, I actually like Made in Manhattan. This was the fairy tale story with Jennifer Lopez as a New York maid in a luxury hotel who is mistaken for a socialite by a handsome New York politician, Ralph Fiennes. I know. The film is directed by Wayne Wang, who gave a smoke and blew in the face, and revisiting it, I got to review this on Fox 59 AM back in the day, and I remember even saying then, yeah, I actually like this. I shouldn't, but I did. It's a silly princess story. It just so happens that the princess is a hotel maid, and we wish all hotel maids look like 20-something Jennifer Lopez. But I actually liked the chemistry between her and Fiennes. Some say that there is a lot of chemistry. I think I was also happy that Ralph Fiennes got to do comedy. After Schindler's List, a lot of dark and heavy films. He's been able to do lighter fare since, but he should be allowed to do more comedy. Grand Budapest Hotel aside. But the film feels like a really good band doing a cover version of Pretty Woman. What it does, besides having your two leads, but it's following the Richard Curtis rule, you have a strong bench. You have Stanley Tucci as Ralph Fiennes' campaign manager. You have Natasha Richardson, who's having fun chewing it up as a flighty socialite who has eyes for Ralph Fiennes. And as my wife and I have pointed out, playing the Hector Elizondo role as the old, very caring but stern sage is Bob Hoskins as the head butler of the hotel. And I believe recently the AV Club will every other week do a column about noted romantic comedies, and they did a nice write-up on Made in Manhattan. So, yeah, I like Matthew Sosi like Made in Manhattan, and it's out on Blu-ray if you're into that. So go check that out. And that's what I've been watching to cleanse my palate. That and I had a midnight screening of 1975's Cleopatra Jones at my house. Of course, that's Tamara Dobson as a special agent who also happens to dress like a fashion model who goes to war with a lesbian drug-dealing kingpin played by Shelley Winters. You also have Bernie Casey in this film, Antonio Fargas. J.J. Johnson, Indy's own J.J. Johnson, does the film score. And this was it's not the female slaughter. It's Cleopatra Jones. Not Cleopatra Schwartz, thanks to Kentucky Fried Movie. But this was a film. I've always enjoyed it, and I was able to buy it on Blu-ray because I need the sound clearer and a crisper screen with Cleopatra Jones. But this was a film I watched on Saturday night at midnight after I got off work. There are certain films you do that. I wasn't going to go into the Ingmar Bergman box set to watch something after, because my Saturday nights, I do the house party, unless I'm working on a play or emceeing somewhere. And then by the time I get home, and there's a local watering hole near where I live, I can hit the last call and the last 40, 45 minutes of the band playing that evening. And then I go home, and I'll try to create a light snack, not a heavy snack, although that struggle is still happening today. And then settle down and wind down after a Saturday night of work, and watching Cleopatra Jones at midnight just fit. So it's not a new title. It's on Warner Archive, but I have it, and maybe you should too. Anyway, friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie, you deserve it. And if the Academy Awards make you go check out those films, bully for you. I hope you do. Anyway, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!